This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, we'll hear from Superintendent and President of Cuesta College, Dr. Jill Stearns.
I really want to acknowledge the great vision that Dr. Gil Stork had for the Cuesta Promise. He worked with the community to make that happen with the Cuesta College Foundation.
Also, we'll hear from the author of the book Oldest San Francisco, which captures an array of fascinating stories of San Francisco's oldest places.
The first rainbow flag, and it was lost for many years, but then found in 2019 and returned to this museum.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 10th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with working lunch.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and your host today, and this is the Working Lunch. The SLO Chamber has formed a direct partnership with KCBX to bring you these working lunch discussions. Each month, we will sit down and meet with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We'll be bringing you conversation with folks who are doing interesting things and impacting the business community that help them meet the challenges of our current business environment. We hope you will join us for these conversations every month on KCBX's Issues and Ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with Dr. Jill Stearns. Dr. Stearns is the superintendent and president of Cuesta College. Cuesta College is our local community college located here in San Luis Obispo with campuses in Paso Robles and Arroyo Grande. Hello, Dr. Stearns. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Jim. It's great to be here with you.
Well, it was a little over 60 years ago that the voters of San Luis Obispo County approved the formation of countywide junior college district. And almost exactly 60 years ago, Cuesta College opened its doors to the community. Cuesta College has grown to incorporate 84 degree programs, 128 certificate programs, and 17,360 students. Dr. Stearns, as the superintendent and president of Cuesta College, can you share a little bit about how you came to the profession of college administration and what specifically brought you to Cuesta College?
Absolutely. So I had an indirect route to community colleges. As a matter of fact, I was building a gas station with a car wash and convenience store and had been teaching at the local high school, building some websites to support students and advance their learning that way. When I had an opportunity to apply to go to work for West Hills Community College District, where my entree was really in distance learning in 2000. And so that took me to a place I had never been before. I had not attended a community college. And when I got there and I started to understand the mission and see the way lives were changed at the community college, I was 100% sold. And over the course of 12 years, moved from being a part-time classified professional employee to having served 4 years as the vice president of instruction, and then went to Modesto Junior College, where I served as president for 6 years, and just have finished my sixth year at Cuesta College.
Distance learning in 2000, what did that look like?
It was not as sophisticated and interactive as it is today. At that time, you might recall that computers were pinging when you tried to dial up to the internet. And so the courses were not video heavy. They were not even image heavy and really relied on text content for students. And so it's been amazing to watch the transformation to be fully interactive video heavy, intense interactions for our students.
Yeah, that's so neat to have been able to see 20, now 4 years of distance learning changes. And I can imagine how that's really changed. And I know how much you all did during COVID to keep students engaged, especially when you couldn't have them come to classes. It was truly amazing. But one of the most interesting things, you know, as tuition for our four-year universities have continued to spiral up and start to put education out of reach for a large part of our population, our community college system has done an amazing job of making education accessible to our community. The Cuesta Promise is an amazing program. that grants Slo County High School grads 2 years of fee-free attendance and lots of other financial aid opportunities for students. And overall, just in general, a very low cost of less than $50 per unit if you're a California state resident. How has Cuesta made all this possible, or the system made all that possible?
I really want to acknowledge the great vision that Dr. Gil Stork had for the Cuesta Promise. He worked with the community to make that happen with the Cuesta College Foundation. There was an incredible anchor gift of $8 million from the Dovica family that was transformational, and that allowed Cuesta to launch with the first year of the promise. The foundation has continued that effort to build the endowment, and now we offer the 2 years fee-free. And what we are able to do with that is there are a number of different models in the state of California, but we are able to not just limit it to our traditional high school graduates. We offer that to local GED completers. We open that up for people who complete through an adult high school pathway to really support our local students. And since we're talking about the foundation, they had a huge milestone they just passed this year. They achieved $1 million in direct aid to students this past year. And it included the Cuesta Promise. It included scholarships for students. And it includes our program of emergency grants that gets cash in the hands of the students when they have that life interruption that would keep them from being able to attend.
And you know, you certainly hear Stanford, Harvard, you know, there are foundations that for those massive private universities like that. I'm not sure if a lot of people know that Cuesta has its own foundation, that your team does fundraising and brings in dollars. So this isn't just money coming from the government, right? This is
absolutely not. This is all locally contributed funds, much of it held in endowments, individuals who are honoring lost loved ones this way through scholarships and other recognitions. And it's not limited just to direct student support. It also provides innovation funds for programs for our faculty who have an idea that they would like to try. It assists the college in a number of critical ways.
Such an important part where, you know, talk about really investing in your community when you donate, right? These are people, again, of all ages, groups, coming to learn, and those dollars going straight into programs, financial aid, and really empowering our community. That is really amazing. And what an amazing gift to have gotten back with the original $8 million. To have gotten you to this point. But then you're clearly doing more to keep it going, and the team is, to have done $1 million in 1 year seems pretty incredible.
It is. And included in that is a new ongoing annual commitment gift from Jim and Karen Clark in support of nursing and our pre-hospital programs that gives each incoming student $200 when they start to help cover the cost of uniforms and other things that they may need, and gives them $800 when they complete. And that can be put toward the cost of their national exams, which are expensive, or to just help that launch that individual from being a student into the local workforce.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. We are here with Dr. Jill Stearns, president of Cuesta College. We're talking about our community college asset right here in Slo County. Our community college system, Cuesta, has done a great job of being that place to educate, train, upskill our workforce for the county. I talked earlier about those 128 certificate programs like nursing that you were just referencing, and this newest edition of the aviation mechanic certificate. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about both, like, was it a view that something was missing for nursing and aviation? How did all of that kind of come to be?
In this case, our partner ACI Jet and their CEO, Bill Borgsmiller, he and I met one another and he said, Jill, I need to talk to you. And he shared with me the real need for aviation maintenance technicians. Not something I'm familiar with, don't have any background there. And we had a great conversation and he was very compelling. And I said, I need to go back to campus. I need to do some research. And when I came back and we engaged in that research, not only was there a very significant local need, so not only was availability of licensed technicians preventing ACI Jet from growing as they desired, but there was a statewide need and a national need that is massive. And so that began the journey in partnership with ACI Jet with the support of our County Board of Supervisors that has brought that program to fruition. And on August 2nd, the first cohort will complete.
I have a personal connection to this. Back when I used to live and work down in the city of Los Angeles, we had Van Nuys Airport in our district, and we literally had a similar college program for aviation mechanics because, and I don't know that people know this, right, that there is a shortage of everything around aviation, but mechanics are another huge part. And it's a great job. So you're creating like head of household jobs.
And what we have learned since is there's this amazing connection not only with space, and we are exploring the development of two additional courses for those individuals interested that would take them from the A&P, which is the licensure from the aviation maintenance tech, to having that skill set that our partners at Vandenberg are looking for. And also there's an intersection with offshore wind because the turbine technicians and their skill set aligns very, very closely with an A&P technician.
It really is forward-looking jobs that are being kind of trained for at our community college system, and that's really special. I'm so glad to hear about all those things. I mean, one of the other program tracks that at Cuesta could fill a current gap and a major future need in our community, and that's the early childhood education track. You know, this track, it seems to look to develop the next generation of teachers or childcare workers. And as you know from your time with us on the Slow Chamber Board, this workforce is a major focus of our work. It looks like the CSUs and the community college have gotten together to create some major benefits to transfer, to incentivize folks to go into this line of work. Can you talk a little bit about those incentives? And is that a new thing or has this been done before?
It's been done before and it's ongoing. And currently our early childhood education students are being compensated through a grant when they are doing their required lab hours in the children's center. And so that is tremendous because instead of that significant impact on their time, just being a learning experience, now it's a paid learning experience. And so that is a pretty significant incentive for some. Additionally, San Luis County Office of Education has acquired a number of grants over the years that will cover the cost of those individuals, local individuals who seek to teach in our local schools and to help them advance through an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and a teaching credential. So there's a tremendous amount of support. This is an area that is not highly compensated, which is significant challenge in our community. It's underappreciated. And similar to the airplane industry that we were talking about before, we have an aging workforce and they anticipate huge swaths of retirement that are going to continue to impact this area.
I was just at a meeting of the school districts at the County Office of Education, and we were talking specifically about the lack of workforce available for teachers. We are losing young teachers very quickly, and so building some of these pieces to help them land, obviously at some point, especially to be in our community, we got to fix some of their compensation pieces. Again, I know this will be a problem for all of California, but having some of these great programs available seems at least a step in the right direction to try and incentivize some of this work. Are you seeing at the the teacher level at Cuesta, or is it a little different at that point?
We have tremendous, tremendous interest in our full-time teaching positions. I would say more challenging to fill our part-time positions, but full-time, we have incredibly talented pools of individuals who seek to come here. And I would say the values that the chamber holds resonate with the faculty members who want to be in this area. And so it's a good fit.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. We are here with Dr. Jill Stearns, president of Cuesta College. We're talking about our community college asset right here in SLO County. As part of that, and thinking about staffing, you know, you're one of our few Red Diamond Award-winning family-friendly workplace. That's our highest level, that childcare on site. Is that for staff, students, the community, all the above, none of the above? How does that work? And are students getting real-world experience in that childcare center?
Yes, yes, and yes. So our children's centers, and we have one both on the San Luis Obispo campus and at the North County campus in Paso Robles, they are learning labs that support our early childhood education program. And so that is, they are centered on that. And then the availability of childcare is secondary to that. And I would say that is one of the challenges that we continue to search for solutions. And we recognize that at this point in time, the structure of our childcare center, and it's the same at all of the California community colleges. We have the same challenge, the same struggle. It probably works best for employees because the schedule is centered around that. And so we're continue to seek ways, how do we change that? How can we fund a model that would allow it to fit better for students who need a place for their children from 10 to 2:30 when they're in class, but they don't need that opportunity from 8 to 5, 5 days a week. And so there are, yes, it is available on campus. We do have students that are part of that, but primarily it serves employees and the community. I will say we have a model in place for our non-credit ESL program that is grant funded that is that drop-in model. It's available in the evenings. It's actually not in our children's centers. We use other space on campus. And so because of that external funding opportunity, we are able to do that for that limited program, and it's a critical resource.
Yeah, I mean, we've been working on this a while, just trying to figure out private sector childcare, and it is not happening because, again, wages, the cost to provide, insurance, everything that goes with it makes it very difficult. It's awesome to hear that that's working because it's a learning lab from that piece, but also because of some external grant funding, being able to provide that outside hour. It's the struggle we've had greatest with in trying to help the tourism industry, right, with childcare or farm, ag, all of that. I think at some point we're going to have to just figure out that it's not going to be ever solved in a fully 100% private sector model, but we got to figure out then how are we going to fund it. Do you get feedback from your faculty and staff about the childcare center and the benefits you provide?
Certainly those individuals that come to us from private industry, being that we are a governmental employee, our family bonding leave and other programs that we offer for our employees feel incredibly generous in comparison. I will say that our new parents would like more.
Again, as it's harder to get your children, you know, settled, how are you getting them connected? All of that, you know, coming out of the Gen X latchkey kids, right?
Right.
I think we've seen as parents, we want to create more space for those things.
And I think you hit the nail on the head that private sector appears to have shrunk. There used to be much more availability of informal arrangements where there was a neighborhood home that provided care. And that model seems to really have maybe run its course. And that that impacts the availability of the workforce to access care.
Yeah, it's really a challenge as always. But, you know, again, great work that Quest is doing to try to solve it, a long-term solution and some of those interim steps, hopefully, to Band-Aid over. I want to switch topics a little bit. I've seen a lot of new construction happening on campus. What's the latest going on there? There's some beautiful new buildings going up, right? In the SLO campus, I know that.
Yes, and one coming to the North County campus that will break ground probably early fall, so we look forward to that as well. What you're seeing on the San Luis Obispo campus right now that looks like a giant erector set because all of the steel is in place, that is the new campus center, and it replaced the old administration building, which was one of the original buildings on campus. And it is going to have the first floor is where a community member can come in with interest in Cuesta and walk out the door a student with a schedule. So all of those onboarding student services, including counseling and financial aid, are going to be in that building and a nice little coffee shop. So we take care of all of our first-time visitors' needs. And then what had previously been in the administration building will be on the second floor, and the Cuesta College Foundation will also be there.
Very cool. Great to see the campus growing, modernizing, again, to make it easier for folks to access because, again, you're providing so many opportunities with those certificate programs and associate degrees. I always like to end our discussion with a little bit of forecasting about the future. Since you're getting a view of our future workforce and leaders, what are the opportunities or challenges you see coming down the road for us on the Central Coast?
So we continue to be engaged in the offshore wind conversations and are listening intently and have contacted a number of colleges and universities and areas in the United States that are further along in their offshore wind development to see what programs have become associated with that. It appears that's a ways down the road still, so we are excited about the opportunity and fit that we see between our aviation maintenance and that. In the fall, we are launching a program that 100% is designed to meet needs of local employers, and that is a non-credit commercial driving program. And being non-credit, it's at no cost to the participants, and there will be different opportunities for Class B license, for Class A license, and commercial trucking. And so I'm very excited to have that come forward. And that need really became apparent to me when I was serving on the Workforce Development Board.
If folks want to learn more about how to come to Cuesta College or engage in some of the programs, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can always find us at cuesta.edu, but you're also very welcome to come to campus anytime. And I only talked about one project with our bond that's underway. The other major one that has just been completed is signage and wayfinding. Our beautiful California Mission buildings have made that campus difficult to navigate. We have all new wayfinding, and you might even see the sign on our Performing Arts Center now that says Cuesta College. You can find us from Highway 1. And for the first time ever, we have a physical address. We're at 3000 Education Drive.
I'm not going to say that maybe I've been lost on the campus before. So that's very exciting for me personally. I really appreciate that. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stearns, for joining us today and sharing some of your thoughts. To you, our listeners, thank you for joining us for this important conversation. On behalf of Dr. Jill Stearns of Cuesta College, KCBX, and I'm Jim D'Antona for the SLO Chamber of Commerce, we hope you have an amazing week. Keep making our community a wonderful place to live.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman. This summer, you might be thinking about a road trip. Up next, we have a writer who has some ideas for you if you want to explore San Francisco's history.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We're at the KCBX studios in San Luis Obispo, California, and I'm here with Alex Scott. You are a full-time professional writer, unlike a lot of people that freelance part-time after work and whatever.
Sure.
So it's a double struggle because you have to make your income and get your assignments or...
Yeah, I was at the CBC in Canada, and when we moved down here, I sort of added some teaching and became a fellow who said yes to editors and cobbled together enough writing work to make it worthwhile.
I remember Smithsonian is one of your regular outlets.
Yeah, I write for them and sometimes for The Guardian, and I've written a lot for the San Francisco Chronicle and San Francisco Magazine and Sunset. And then
Toronto Magazine, right?
Yeah, I was a lawyer, and then I left that to my journalist friend said I was crazy to join the staff of a city magazine called Toronto Life. But I found my people. I was so happy. Not that lawyers weren't my people, but I was so happy to be with all these crazy journalists again. So,
did being a lawyer serve you well as being a wordsmith?
Well, not really, but I always liked to write. I worked on the college paper, and I was a libel and slander lawyer, so I was working with journalists. But it gave me some discipline that I sorely needed. So, you know, A to B to C, following every lead, like good journalists are supposed to do. So it was helpful in that the writing, I have to try and turn off the lawyer side to write a bit.
So. But that craftsmanship as a writer... It probably some parallels. If you don't dot your I as a lawyer, you might lose a case.
Well, there you go. Yeah, for sure. And one of the reasons I went into law is that there's an overlapping skill set with argument and putting together thoughts. But some lawyers are great writers, and many are not as good.
So. Back in the day, you guys got paid by the word.
Yes, that is true.
So kind of a reverse going on there because you want to be tight and concise.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
So in addition to writing for magazines on assignment, you are also an author.
Yeah, in COVID, I took a novel that had long been in the drawer and worked on it and got that published by a small, reputable publisher. And that was great, a long-time dream. And then I was asked if I would write a book on San Francisco by a publisher in the Midwest. And they've done a series of books called Oldest Chicago and Oldest New York. And they cut this interesting swath through the cities where they talk about the businesses that have survived and other things that were pioneered in different cities. I wasn't doing as much travel writing as I'd been doing before COVID. And so when they approached me, I said, hell yes, I will take that. Thank you.
And you can probably spin off a lot of those stories, right?
I hope to do some of that. They'll probably excerpt a couple of local publications will probably do some excerpts.
So. Well, SF Gate, the online platform in San Francisco, would seem a total natural.
They do beautiful work on San Francisco history. And in fact, a lot of the times when I was researching something, I would come up on a beautiful story about the oldest diner, and someone had grown up going there and he'd written about it for SF Gate or that sort of thing.
So the name of your book is?
Oldest San Francisco.
Get right to the point.
Yeah, there you go. We tried to get stuff that was very San Francisco. I went to see the oldest blue jeans in a vault at the Levi's History Museum. I felt like I was seeing the Shroud of Turin coming out of it and worn by miners. This was important to me. I saw the first rainbow flag, which had a couple more colors, which was in a lesbian and gay history.
So that's where it was invented.
It was by this Vietnam vet called Gilbert Baker. And he was sort of airy and funny. And Harvey Milk, the famous supervisor.
Who was murdered.
Murdered and asked him for one of the first what they called gay freedom parades. It was not called gay pride yet. Would he come up with a symbol or flag for them? And he, having come from Kansas, knowing the over the rainbow. And anyway, he came up with this rainbow flag, and it was lost for many years, but then found after he died in 2019 and returned to this museum. So it was nice to see that.
That's
so,
really cool.
Yeah.
How about some of your, on the one hand, the iconic places, the Presidio and whatnot that everybody knows. On the other hand, surprises that you bumped into.
Yeah, well, I love following with the Presidio, following the history through Spain, a sort of dusty fort where they sometimes paid people with like cigarettes, right at the end of the Spanish Empire, and then through Mexico, where it got even more neglected. And then through being conquered by the U.S. Without really any shots fired. And then what was nice was the sort of swords into plowshares, how it became this beautiful, almost Central Park-sized park area. Mm-hmm. And then as the book was coming out, they had made a new part of the park accessible, sort of connecting the park with the famous cemetery of many of the war dead in World War II. So it was nice to see layer on layer on layer mm-hmm. of San Francisco in a place like that.
And how about discoveries, surprises that you bump into that you had no clue?
Well, somehow across my feed came this piece from an automobile trade magazine saying that one of the oldest auto shops in the nation was started by a Sicilian immigrant to San Francisco called Babe Aliotto.
Is that the Mayer family?
They're all from Sicily, mm-hmm. and they all are nice to each other. Not related. Although I interviewed the grandson of the founder, Babe, and he said when they went to the restaurant, they were treated great. And the mayor, Mayor Aliotto, one of San Francisco's most famous mayor, gave them a coin when they were born. So yeah, they started by doing Packards, and they would have this huge Christmas party every year, and the cops would come to bust it, but then would end up staying. And they moved from, of course, doing all mechanical work to doing all these incredible computer-driven cars, the Teslas, and they've made all the adjustments over the years, like all these businesses, mm-hmm. to stay fresh. And so what I loved about that was I thought, you know, I'm going to be writing about Tadich Grill, mm-hmm. writing about Ghirardelli, the oldest chocolate maker, writing about all these iconic things, but I didn't realize I'd also get to write about oldest funeral home mm-hmm. or oldest auto shop. So that was fun.
And you wrote about the oldest sourdough bakery.
Yes.
That goes back to the Gold Rush.
Gold Rush, yes. French immigrants. Coming from Canada, I always want to say boudin,
right.
but it's boudin, mm. the way locals say it. And locals used to put a nail on their door so that the deliveries made by wagon, mm. they could just push the loaf onto the onto the door. Yeah. And of course, San Francisco has a famous sourdough story where the yeast in part comes from the air. And then with boudin, they have something they call the mother, which is their starter, which, of course, during COVID, everyone was talking about starters. Mm-hmm. But this one was used from the Gold Rush on. It's still living in a sort of cool area, uh-huh. and it almost died in the earthquake. Boudin was hit. The 1906 quake, everything in their bakery, it was okay from the quake, but then the fires, mm-hmm. the resulting fires were moving towards it. And the wife of one of the master bakers, who also worked full-time in the bakery, as was common, had the forethought to grab the starter and mm-hmm. put it in a pail and take it with her. So it's the same starter that's been with them from the beginning.
Can you get a little pinch of it to make your own?
You cannot.
No.
People have tried to reverse engineer it and so forth.
But that's the magic of their sourdough.
That's right.
It's irreplaceable. You can't fake it.
That's right. And they've done amazing, as is typical in San Francisco, they've moved with the times. Mm-hmm. So their bakery is state of the art now, and they sell it all over in the airport and all over, but it's still the same sourdough.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, KCBX's Tom Wilmer talks with Alex Scott about his book, Oldest San Francisco, which captures an array of fascinating stories of San Francisco's oldest places.
Okay, another favorite that really touched you that was surprising and revealing.
I love digging into the story of the, this is more food, but I guess that's appropriate with San Francisco, such a food-obsessed place. But who started this global success, the Mission Burrito, which started in San Francisco in the Mission and then went global.
When did they start?
In the 60s. Uh-huh. But there are two origin stories. Two different places claim to have invented it, and both are still around. And so one claimed that they were serving hungry firemen in the early 60s, immigrants from Mexico, but had made it as agricultural workers in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. And the other claimed that they had to make the special large tortillas that, as you know, if you've eaten them, they're quite substantial. So the other one's claim is that they were the first ones to make these. A cousin of Carlos Santana, a high school student, every San Francisco story has to have some Carlos Santana
sure,
in it,
yeah.
Was the first to make the extra large tortillas to go.
And are they brick and mortar now, or are they food truck?
They're both brick and mortar.
Where are they located?
One is on Valencia, which has become quite a sort of hipster street, but they're the real deal, mm-hmm. La Cumbre.
And then the other is at the other side of the mission. If they were closer, it might be even more difficult. And it's called El Faro, the lighthouse. And most food historians side, I'm sorry to say, with El Faro. But anyway, they both had a role in making this local dish go national. And one thing I loved there, one of the people I spoke to who has a taqueria said, the mission burrito, not the melting pot, should be America's story. Because you have all the ingredients. You've got the beans, you've got the rice, you've got the avocado. And they're all themselves, but they're in this one big burrito. So I thought, oh, that's nice, right?
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, another favorite story, kind of a must-do if you come to the city, places you can see and experience.
Yeah, well, I always thought as a visitor to the city that Alcatraz would be so touristy, and of course it was. You had to book a long time in advance, but it's really held on to some feeling what it was like. There, the tunnels that people use to try and escape are there. The lighthouse still turns above it. The remnants of the occupation by Native First Nations people are there. The bridge tables where they played near a picture window, looking out at the bright lights of the city, all that freedom sort of visible. So, you know, it was nice to dig into the mystique of the rock and to sort of piece everything together in a way that was reliable but quick. And so, yeah.
And some fresh perspectives.
Yeah, hopefully. You know, there was the oldest hat shop.
All the oldest are still going.
They're all still going. The city had one very sad loss while I was writing it, which was the oldest art school in the west of the country, the Art Institute, which is a storied building, a storied place. Annie Leibovitz learned to photograph there. All these amazing talents came from there. And
what happened? Why did it implode?
Well, I hope that there's still going to be some sort of savior or saving of it. A small school having a difficult time paying their bills. They looked to try and partner with another university. That didn't work. And so a city like San Francisco, there's got to be someone with deep pockets who is going to say, I'm not going to let this go, not on my watch. So,
as I remember, drove by there the other day, and it's like a French language school now?
Yes, they've rented parts of it out. But, you know, there's a huge, almost barn-sized room in there with a mural done by Diego Rivera dramatizing the building of a city like San Francisco and making fun of plutocrats. And it's just a beautiful, massive piece of art. Mm-hmm. And at the back, there's sort of this modern addition to this.
Is it like a fresco so you can't move it?
It is a fresco. They have all the technology to move it, but it's incredibly expensive, so they might have to do that. But in place, it's magic, and the building is great. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm speaking about what's not in the book, but passionate about that. So,
Okay, one more.
Okay. I guess there's a longstanding funeral home run by the same family since the days of the Gold Rush. It always reminded me of one of my favorite shows from the 90s, Six Feet Under. The family who run it have run it since the early 20th century. I spoke to a couple of them, and they estimate that they've put in over 300 years between them all, trying to help people through this very difficult process of losing a loved one. And so many logistics are involved, paperwork and finding the service and so forth. Mm-hmm. But one of them, she talked about how great it was to be able to be at the other end of the phone for these people and just listen and hear them out and handle the logistics. I was expecting that to be really difficult interview to think about it, but I was thinking, wow, in this circumstance, I would love someone who had a calling to do this work, as she clearly did.
So. Well, looking from the outside, your first thought is, well, they prepare the body for burial.
And they do all that.
But there's so much more, like the quote mortician might be like social director and not having to do with actually preparing the body itself.
Yeah, and dealing with the authorities to report on it, or, you know, she was talking about someone who wanted their ashes to be taken to China and how many different people needed to be dealt with, and she sort of helped them walk through all that. Yeah. So lucky them to have found the right person. So,
okay, before we go, one more bonus. This is so fascinating. Think of another tale.
Oh, well, there's a motel on Ocean Beach. It's the oldest motel in San Francisco from the time when we were building all the highways, so the 20s, or building the roads, and we were taking longer road trips, 20s and 30s. They were young when they inherited this, a couple. He was an artist, and she was a dancer and had worked in diplomacy. Her father unexpectedly died, And they said, on sort of a lark, we'll do this. And they had amazing stories of being held up, which were out of Tarantino, sort of Ocean Beach a bit rougher then than it is now. And the way they told stories was one bouncing to the other. And so the man holding them up points a gun at them. They're in the office. She's doing yoga and he's at the front. And he recognizes the gun. He's a bit puzzled. But then he always tries to figure out, are they crazy or is it business? If it's business, we'll just give them the money. Mm-hmm. And if they're crazy, then we're in trouble. And so he realizes it's business. So the guy comes in and he says, give me all the cash in your safe. And he says, I'm a hippie. I don't keep cash around, the guy who owns it. And then he says to the woman who's still in yoga pose, where's your purse? And she wants to get him out of there. So she says, oh, you know, I think it's out in the car. But her husband, who's always a helpful guy, is like, oh, no, no, you just left it over here, right over there. And he's like, she's like, ah. So the way they told that story and the slice of San Francisco life, I just loved getting the chance to talk to them and sit with them and hear about it.
So. That's so cool. Okay, Alec Scott, to learn more about your world, and how would somebody get the book?
The oldest bookstore in the West, Books, Inc., is offering the book through their website. There are pre-orders there, and those ones are signed.
And the name of the book again?
Oh, it's Oldest San Francisco, and its site is oldestsanfrancisco.com.
There you go. Probably on Amazon and whatnot.
It is on Amazon, too, but those ones aren't signed. Only the Books, Inc. ones are signed.
Alec Scott from Oakland, California, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. This has been great. Thank
you. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the KCVX studios in San Luis Obispo, California, where we've been visiting with Alec Scott, author and world traveler.
Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, reporter Ashley Sagat from UC Santa Barbara's student-run radio station KCSB learns about the university's Kegel Autism Center.
Your Brain on Art, the 2024 UCSB Reads book selection, looks at the many ways art supports a healthy brain and helps us learn. The book also explains how to support individuals with a range of intellectual differences. The book mentions data from the CDC that finds 1% of the world's population has been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. To learn more about this and how to support those of us whose brain work differently, I spoke with Anna Krasno, the clinical director of the Kegel Center here at UCSB.
Hi there, my name is Dr. Anna Krasno, and I'm the clinical director of the Kegel Autism Center.
Thank you for joining us here at KCSB. To start off our interview, I was wondering if you can explain what the neurodivergent brain is.
So the word neurodivergent is used to describe differences in brain wiring, and it's an umbrella term that a lot of different labels or diagnoses are under. So some examples of that are autism or ADHD, synesthesia. There's a lot of different types of neurodivergence.
And how would you describe or encompass the autism spectrum disorder?
So in my experience working with autistic people for over 15 years now, we know that autism can present really differently across people. And I like to say that when I've met one person with autism, I've met one person with autism. It's generally comprised of social communication differences. So things like differences in social emotional reciprocity, the back and forth of conversation, perhaps differences in describing one's emotional experience. There's also differences in nonverbal communication skills that can look like things like eye contact or gesture use or facial expression, but it can also be difficulty reading social cues or interpreting social situations. And the last piece of that is difficulty initiating or maintaining friendships or relationships. There's also several behavioral components that include things like intense interests, repetitive behaviors, preference for sameness, and sensory differences.
I've seen on some research that there's some overlap between ADD and ADHD with autism. Would you say that ADD or ADHD is a form of autism?
I would not say that. I do see them as very distinct experiences. At the same time, there is overlap in the diagnostic criteria between autism and ADHD. So things like sensory differences or hyperfixations. People with ADHD can have social challenges, but I see the sort of root of the social challenges being very different between autism and ADHD. So in autism, there's more of a social challenge from kind of not knowing what to do socially. And yeah, just like not knowing how to initiate or how to respond, or a lot of scripting that goes into doing that or preparation ahead of time, where people with ADHD may have more of those, have more social ease kind of naturally.
Can you explain what are some incentives for people to get tested? What signs should they look for if they want to get tested to see if they're on the spectrum?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. At the Cagle Autism Center, we conduct a lot of assessments for folks in adulthood, so people who are getting a first-time diagnosis of autism in adulthood. And I would say it ranges. People come to us when they've felt different from others their whole life. They may see others around them being able to pass their classes and maintain relationships or maintain a job, and they notice they have a lot of difficulty doing those things that everyone else around them seems to be able to do quite easily. They may be able to initiate friendships but have difficulty maintaining them, or have difficulty initiating in the first place. They may experience a lot of sensory overwhelm. So in autism, there can be hypersensitivity to noises and lights and smells and textures, and that can lead to a lot of exhaustion in the body processing that all the time. So sometimes people come in who have had difficulty maintaining a job or relationships or passing their classes, and they just feel like they haven't been on the same wavelength as other people their whole life. And so that usually is the case for adults coming in, and we see all ages. So we've seen people starting at 14 months all the way up to 65 years old.
So the center does offer a range of diagnostic and developmental and psychological assessments for individuals of all ages, as you mentioned before. Can you describe some of these assessments?
Sure. So they vary depending on the age of the client, but generally we always include what we call a cognitive evaluation. So that's getting a sense of the person's cognitive abilities, like verbal comprehension, nonverbal problem solving, working memory, and processing speed. We also do specific autism diagnostic testing. The one we use is called the ADOS. We know that the ADOS has limitations in terms of identifying all different forms of autism, and so we always pair that with a lot of clinical interviewing to really understand the person's experience. If the person wants us to speak to a caregiver or a parent or a sibling or somebody to gather information about their early childhood, we do that also. And we also give self-report questionnaires and other types of questionnaires as well.
So what are the big differences between the assessments between like younger like students or even like to old adults? Like how do you guys vary your testing?
So for the little ones, we do, there's like a developmental test we do. So we're looking at expressive and receptive language skills, fine motor skills, nonverbal problem-solving skills. The ADOS has 5 modules that you can choose from based on age and language level. So the ones for the little kids look a lot like play. And then for more like elementary school children, teenagers, and adults, it looks more like semi-structured interviewing, where we're asking various types of questions to get to know them better. A lot of the tests we have range in age, you know, from 5 to 16 or from 6 to age 99. And so you can use the same test, you're just doing different items.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio with Issues and Ideas. Student reporter Ashley Sagat is speaking with Dr. Anna Krasno from UCSB's Cagle Autism Center.
On your guys' website, there's an emphasis on the importance of comparing everyone's assessment with people within their similar age group. Can you explain what the significance of that is and what aspects change in regards to those results?
So I guess that what that is referring to is that all the tests are normed on average populations. And so for in our cognitive testing, for example, the scores that we get are compared to a lot of people that clients age who have taken the test. And so we're kind of seeing how are they performing in comparison to same age peers. But we also take into consideration developmental differences, and that development can look really different for different people.
And then once someone is diagnosed, depending on their age, what are the next steps? Like for those that are younger, those that are like young adult, mm-hmm. even older adults?
It can really vary. And so for the little kids, we're thinking a lot about helping them develop language skills if they, you know, don't have as much language, to really help them have a voice and power over their environment. So for the little kids, we're recommending things like neurodiverse affirming speech and language therapy or occupational therapy. One of the big recommendations that's been around forever is called ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. There's a lot of contention and debate in the field right now about the utility of ABA and sort of the ethics around it. And what I mean by that is ABA is a very behaviorally based support service that, in listening and talking to a lot of autistic advocates, their experience of ABA has been that it trains them to appear less autistic or to fit in better with non-autistic society, as opposed to really promoting them living as their authentic self. And so this is how, like, sort of the neurodiversity movement talks about it, disability. And I can go into that. It's a long answer.
Please give us the answer. So please, we want to know more.
Autism has, you know, the medical model is very, has been widely used for a very long time. And so the medical model of disability is that the person, the defect is within the person, and it's very negative, deficit-based kind of language that is used in the medical model. And so in the medical model, we think about how can that person change to fit in better with normative society. And it's really not considering what could help that person live authentically and genuinely. And so the neurodiversity model puts forth that disability lies not in the person, but it comes from a poor fit between the person and their environment. And so the responsibility is really on the environment to support and change and affirm differences. And so the contrast between the medical model and the neurodiversity model is such that it's really hard to know what to recommend these days, because at the Kegel Autism Center, we really want to affirm people's differences and help them live authentically. And I can give an example. A lot of historic autism treatment has been to help children make more eye contact, because that's expected in a lot of spaces. And in talking with a lot of autistic kids and teens and young adults and adults, they can experience eye contact as quite uncomfortable and even painful, it's been described to me. Or if they're looking at someone's face, it's a lot harder to hear what they're saying, because if I'm looking at your face, there's a lot more going on that I have to process. And if I'm not looking at you, I can listen better to what you're saying. But eye contact is so expected that when someone doesn't give eye contact, the other person might consider that, you know, interpret that as rude. And so traditional behavioral support for autism, a goal might be to increase eye contact. But at the Kegel Autism Center, that's not ever what we're recommending. We really want to think about affirming a child's differences or an adult's differences and equipping them with a skill set to help them achieve their goals. And so for adults, or like young adults and adults, there's no prescribed treatment. We don't use the word treatment. We say support services. We're not going to recommend any support that is targeting the core pieces of autism. We have an adult services program at the Kegel Autism Center where we help UCSB students, staff and faculty, and community members on various goals around social communication, time management, organization, maybe daily living skills. So it's things that they drive the goals. It's things they want to work on. We're not coming in with like, this is what you should do now that you have a diagnosis. So it's really up to the person, you know, to initiate what the help that they want if they feel they need it. So it really, really ranges. And for kids, we're thinking about if there's, you know, school considerations or out of school support considerations. You know, how do we help a child live authentically socially? Like maybe the parent expects them to have a bunch of friends, but they just want one friend. And so kind of balancing that in the family as well.
So with the implications of diagnosing autism, we've seen that like having it go undiagnosed for like as you go on in life, mm-hmm. how does that affect a child, a young adult, like mm-hmm. at the times that they get diagnosed in their mm-hmm. lifetime? Like what lifestyle changes do you see with them through your support services?
Okay, so I'll take a step back and just speak generally to the point you just made is, and this is like literally I think about this all the time and it's such an important issue, is there aren't a lot of providers who understand that autism can present really, really widely and really, really differently. And so if they're sitting across from, you know, an assigned female at birth individual who's fully verbal, who does make eye contact, it's probably unlikely that that person is considering autism as a potential diagnosis. But what we know is that an autistic person can speak and make eye contact and be in college and have a diagnosis of autism. So what we see a lot at the Kegel Autism Center is people coming in late for a diagnosis, and they've typically been seen by other like local providers or people who have done comprehensive evaluations but have not considered autism as part of the evaluation. And so a person might be presenting with symptoms of depression and anxiety or like maybe obsessive compulsive traits or repetitive behaviors, maybe even like suicidal ideation. And so a provider, if the person sitting across from them doesn't appear or like look autistic, then they'll probably just give them multiple diagnoses like depression, anxiety, OCD, ADHD, sensory processing disorder. And so a lot of people we see are coming in with like four or five other diagnoses that they've been given to account for the characteristics that people can see. And there hasn't been consideration for what the root of those issues are. And so we see so much that undiagnosed and unsupported autism can really lead to feelings of depression and anxiety, can lead to social withdrawal. And to me, like accurate diagnosis is absolutely crucial because, for example, a teenager who's given like five different diagnoses instead of autism has a different life trajectory. Because if we know about the autism, then that person has the language to describe their experience. The family has the language to describe the child's experience, and it can lead to different types of support approaches than if this person is given all these other diagnoses. So it can be really frustrating. We see it a lot. And there's a lot of, like we see UCSB students who have been undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, and then they struggle at UCSB kind of not knowing this about them and not knowing where to find helpful supports. Yeah.
So for your guys, once someone is diagnosed, how do you guys provide that support for the community, specifically those that like attend UCSB? Like what mm-hmm. resources are available for students since they're diagnosed either later or even students mm-hmm. that have been diagnosed since they were younger?
We have an adult services program. Right now it's in a model of 1 hour a week. And so the client works with a graduate student in counseling, clinical and school psychology under my supervision for 1 hour a week. And it's not mental health therapy. We call it behavior skills training. So it's really thinking about what are some observable and measurable goals that are feasible to achieve in the next like 3, 6, or 9 months. And so we help people really narrow down goals to be very specific and very achievable. And they can really range. So if it's a UCSB student, they might be working on advocating for themselves with professors or TAs. It might be, you know, passing their classes. And then we're looking at the syllabi together. We're putting together like when are office hours, when are the study sessions, when are the midterms and the finals, and really getting that all laid out, helping, you know, with study habits and things like that. maybe the person is experiencing conflict with roommates or friends, and so we're thinking about those pieces as well. We also have an organization called TEAM that is run by undergraduates, and that does like study jams and hangouts, you know, throughout the quarter just to increase feeling of like community and sense of belonging.
That was the interview I had with Clinical Director Anna Krasno about how we look at those with autism spectrum disorder and the importance of diagnosing someone for both their safety and their health. Thank you for listening. This is Ashley Sagat with KCSB News.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.